A matter of luck. A program dedicated to the greatest inventor and scientific discoverer the world has known, Lady Luck. And bringing you in one complete 30-minute presentation, two authentic and true stories of remarkable scientific achievement. Tonight we tell you of Henri Becquerel and Edward Goodrich Aitchison, and how each became famous through a matter of luck. Henri Becquerel and a matter of luck. The discovery of X-rays by Conrad Röntgen in 1895 set the scientists and philosophers of the world agog. Here was something for the mind to ponder on, a mysterious and unexplained radiation whose nature none of them fully understood. And many and varied were the theories advanced to account for the strange phenomenon. Two men in particular were absorbed in the problem: Poincaré, the great French mathematician, and Henri Becquerel, third in line of a noted family of physicists. In 1896, these two learned men put their heads together to explore a new line of research opened up by Poincaré. And one evening, Becquerel called at his house to discuss it.
Pull up to the fire, my dear Becquerel. You may as well talk in comfort, eh?
Yeah, by all means. The man who said that intellect thrived on discomfort didn't know what he was talking about.
Quite. Pass the poker over, would you? Suzette, bring more coal, if you please. There. Now then. I've been studying the findings of our German friend Röntgen on emanations of the cathode tube. X-rays, as he chose to call them. And I'm going to suggest attacking the problem of their nature from a new angle.
Precisely how?
So far, the rays have been studied from their source. I propose to look into their effects. Ah, here's Suzette with our coal. Straight onto the fire with it, Suzette.
Yes, monsieur.
That's all, thank you. You may go. Oh, a hot glass of something good for both of us in an hour, Suzette.
In 1 hour, monsieur.
I didn't quite follow your last remark. The effects of X-rays, was it?
Yes. I propose to study their effect rather than their source.
I'm afraid I still don't see the trend of your idea.
Phosphorescence. I have a theory that X-rays may lie at the bottom of phosphorescence. And if we study it closely, we may arrive at some clue that will help us to understand the cathode tube.
Ah, very good, very good. My friend, I am just the man to help you. As you know, my father made a very careful study of phosphorescence. But, of course, X-rays were after his time.
You like this notion of mine?
Very much indeed. I shall resume the subject where my father left off. Yes, he'd like that.
How far did he get with it?
He found he'd exhausted the subject when he investigated the phosphorescent salts of uranium and thorium, from pitchblende, you know.
Yes, yes.
Now, starting quite blind, as we might say, let us follow in Röntgen's footsteps. I believe his first inkling of X-rays was something to do with photographic plates, was it not?
Yes, a key photographed itself when his cathode tube lay nearby.
Correct. Now, what I propose is this. Phosphorescence is stimulated by light. I shall expose a salt of uranium to bright light while resting on a totally enclosed plate. If there is any connection between phosphorescence and X-rays, then there should be a photographic exposure.
Hmm. When do you propose to start?
When? Why not tonight? Why not at once? Now, let us discuss details of apparatus and procedure.
As Henri Becquerel discovered in the weeks of experiment that followed, there was no connection whatever between phosphorescence and X-rays, and Poincaré's theory was wrong. But it was the lucky chance that gave Becquerel a remarkable discovery. At first, he was at a loss to understand the evidence of his own eyes. But when its significance dawned upon him, he hurried at once to tell his friend the astounding news.
Poincaré! Poincaré!
What is it, Henri? Calm yourself. Has there been an accident?
No. Yes, yes, there has been.
Well, come and sit down and tell me all...
I don't want to sit down. Poincaré, you know that I have been studying uranium.
Yes.
Looking for X-rays from it.
Yes, yes, yes. What is it?
And you know that we were both quite wrong in our phosphorescence theory. But I have found that uranium gives off some kind of rays spontaneously, all the time.
No, no, you can't make me believe that.
It is true, and I can prove it. Wrap up a piece of uranium with a photographic plate, as I did, in 10 square meters of paper to exclude the light if you want to. Leave it for a while, and soon you will find your plate exposed. Try it.
Is this true, Becquerel? You're not... No.
I couldn't believe my eyes at first. I said to myself, Henri...
Uranium must give off light.
No, no, no. These rays are not light. In a pitch-black room, you could not even see the uranium I use.
Is it heat, then?
Heat? When the stuff is cold to the touch? No, Poincaré. By accident, by luck, I have discovered a new kind of ray, something mysterious without even a name. It's not light. It's not heat. It's just there.
Becquerel's discovery fascinated scientists all over the world, and in particular, two famous people, Marie and Pierre Curie. This brilliant couple worked in Paris at the School of Physics in the Rue de la Glacière, and they seized on the new development and studied it closely. Using delicate instruments, they measured Becquerel's mysterious rays and discovered much about their nature. Then, by extraordinary mathematical deduction, Marie Curie proved that the salts of uranium and thorium alone were not responsible for the rays, but that a third and hitherto unknown element was mixed with them. This they called radium, and its emanations they named radioactivity, and at once set to work to isolate the new element. Henri Becquerel followed the course of their research with great interest. As all the world knows, in 1901 the Curies succeeded in isolating radium, and one day, soon after their sensational success, Becquerel called at their laboratory to make a request.
Marie, come here. We have a distinguished visitor.
Who is it?
Professor Becquerel from the Museum of Natural History.
Oh, Professor Becquerel. We are honored, monsieur.
Not at all, madame. It is you who do me the honor. How does your work go?
Now that we've isolated our pure radium, the worst of the task is over. But we still have a long way to go. A long, hard way.
That is what I keep dinning into the heads of my students. No matter how far one pushes ahead in science, there is still a long way to go. But to come to the point of my visit, I have a request to make.
I think I can guess what it is, Professor. You wish to borrow some radium. Am I right?
Is it asking too much?
What do you say, Marie? Can we spare a milligram or two?
For anyone else, I should say no. But for you, Professor, of course.
Madame Curie, 1,000 thanks. I know the magnitude of my request with radium so scarce and of such value,
but... Please say no more, Professor. It is a pleasure. We have not forgotten who discovered radioactivity in the first place. Have we, Pierre?
Most certainly not.
Give me no credit for that, I pray you. It was nothing but a lucky accident when I was following up a silly theory.
I think you are too modest, monsieur. At all events, you shall get your radium. I shall prepare you a small tube of radium bromide this minute.
And so Henri Becquerel went away with the small glass tube of radium tucked in his waistcoat pocket, little thinking that he was about to make his second and even more remarkable discovery, again through luck. As he had said to the Curies, radium was so rare as to be almost priceless. And in order to run no risk of losing his microscopic speck, he kept the tube in his pocket when it was not lying on his laboratory bench. Then after several weeks, he noticed a strange and disturbing occurrence, something he had to show the Curies.
Monsieur Curie, this is a rather delicate matter. Perhaps, madame, if you wouldn't mind, it's rather a delicate matter.
You have me thoroughly mystified, Professor. But if you wish me to withdraw...
Yes, please, if you would be so kind.
Very well. But I insist on hearing all about it later.
No, monsieur. What is all this mystery?
What are you doing now?
I am stripping to the waist.
But what's the matter? Do you want to fight a duel or something?
Patience, my dear fellow. There. Now then. I am healthy and in good condition, you agree?
Yes, but I won't vouch your mind at the moment.
Observe. Here, just above my waistline. What do you see?
I see what looks like a particularly nasty burn, or an ulcer. How did you do it?
That is what I want you to tell me. I noticed it first about 10 days ago, since when it has become steadily worse.
Then why don't you see your physician? I am not a physician.
I have already done so. He simply throws up his hands. No unguent, no salve has any effect on it. I began to think I'd contracted some wretched disease to produce such an ulceration. Until this morning, when I suddenly realized what might be the cause.
I implore you, Professor, come to the point. What are you driving at?
Simply this. The ulcer is directly beneath the pocket where I've been carrying the little glass tube of radium. Always it has been in the same pocket of my waistcoat. Now I ask you, is it not more than a coincidence?
The radium rays. Yes. Oh, God bless my soul, what have you found this time?
Marie! Marie, come quickly!
But my shirt, monsieur. Wait till I don my shirt.
This is no time for modesty. Marie!
What's the matter, Pierre? Oh, why is Professor Becquerel half naked?
Because you must see for yourself what radium rays do to human tissue. There, look on his body. See? The ulcer.
So? Oh, Pierre, you are sure of this?
Almost. He has been carrying the radium about in the same pocket.
Oh, we must be certain of this. It's of vital importance. Pierre, we will both strap a particle of radium to our arms and make certain once and for all. If we both develop an ulcer on our arms beneath the radium, oh, pray to God we do.
Pierre and Marie Curie soon had radium burns on their arms, similar to that of Professor Becquerel, and there was no longer any room for doubt. The radioactivity of radium destroyed human tissues, and the significance of it did not escape them.
My friends, who can say what benefits this discovery may bestow on mankind? If radium eats away healthy tissue, it must also eat away diseased flesh. It is too soon to say, of course, but we may be on the road to conquering humanity's most loathsome curse.
Do you mean cancer, Professor?
I mean cancer, madam. I mean that radium may be used to destroy the malignant tumors of cancer. And though I may be laughed at for saying it, I see the hand of Providence in my two accidental discoveries. Yes, Providence.
Henri Becquerel and the Curies and their original work on radioactivity have passed into the history of science and medicine. But the part played by Lady Luck will never be forgotten. The false assumption of Poincaré, the mathematician, a professor of physics who carried radium about in his pocket. These were the unconnected whims of fortune that resulted in great discoveries. The finding of radioactivity and its effects were not a matter of intent. They were just a matter of luck. In just 1 minute, we will tell you our second fascinating story, that of Edward Aitchison. We pause now for a brief word from our announcer. Back now to our narrator and cast for our second Stranger Than Fiction story. Edward Aitchison and a Matter of Luck. Romantic is the story of Edward Goodrich Aitchison, who was born of poor parents in Washington, Pennsylvania in 1856. He was forced to earn his living in the coal mines at an early age. But with exceptional energy, he devoted his leisure to experiment and study in electricity and mechanics, with such success that by the time he was 23, he was offered employment as assistant to none other than Thomas Alva Edison. In 1881, Edison secured a contract to install electric lights in Italy, Belgium, and Holland. And since he was going to Europe, he decided to furnish an exhibit of some of his scientific discoveries at the Paris International Exhibition being held that year. So he went to Paris with a staff of technicians and took Aitchison as his chief assistant. There they attended a great reception, a function whose splendor dazzled the young scientist, and where he met the person who gave him what he thought was a great idea.
My dear Dr. King, this is a surprise. Why, I haven't seen you for... Why, it must be nearly 5 years.
Must be all of that, Edison. I guess you're over here for the exhibition.
And some rather big business.
Well, I'm delighted to hear it. Oh, Countess, I beg your pardon. And may I present Mr. Thomas Edison, the famous inventor, Countess Antoinette de Houbigant.
Well, how do you do, ma'am?
Paris is lucky this season, monsieur, with so many famous men here. You have a showing at the exhibition?
Yes, but I'm afraid it's very dull and scientific. The only people who come to look at it are greybeards from Europe's universities. I should say Dr. King's interests would be more to your taste, Countess.
Dr. King and his diamonds? Oh, but yes. I hear he is making New York the jewelry center of the world.
Tiffany's Fifth Avenue have the jewels, Countess, but it takes the women of Paris to wear them.
You are, what you say, a flatterer, no? But I like it. Who is the handsome young man coming towards us?
Oh, the tall fellow? Well, that's my second in command here, a very clever young scientist named Aitchison. Would you like to meet him, Countess?
But yes.
Oh, Edward, come over here a minute. Here are some people I want you to meet. Countess Antoinette de Houbigant, Mr. Edward Aitchison, and Dr. King.
How do you do, Countess? Dr. King, sir.
And I always thought that men of science had long gray hair and eyebrows sticking out, so...
Oh, look here, King. There are one or two things I'd rather like to talk to you about. Do you think we might excuse ourselves?
Oh, I think so. Adelaide?
Yes, yes, off you go. I know you only want to smoke your horrid cigars, and this young man will look after me. Eh, Mr. Asherson?
Well, yes. That is, certainly, ma'am.
Very well, then. Come along, Edison. We'll see you two later in the evening.
Now, tell me, Monsieur Asherson, why are you not dancing?
Well, I've never had time to learn. You see, this is the first time I've ever been anywhere like this. Are you really a countess?
Of course, silly boy. Why not?
It was just that... we were as poor as church mice when I was growing up. I lived on the wrong side of the tracks, as we say in America. I spent all my time studying and working. I never had a cent for anything but books.
But now you are a clever scientist. You will soon be rich, no?
Well, I'm afraid not. I guess I'll never have much money. But I have dreamed of a life like this. Often.
Then why should you not have it, eh? Tell me that.
Well, scientists like Mr. Edison seem to make a lot of money, but I'm not so much an inventor as an investigator. My long suit is research.
But why should you not find something worth a lot of money from this research? What is the phrase? Search and you will find. What about the men who find, well, diamonds? Do they not look and look here and there until they find them?
Oh, yeah, but Madonna, Countess, I'm not a prospector looking for diamonds.
I know a man who looks for them, and not in Africa or Brazil either, in his laboratory. He says he will be the richest man in the world someday with his artificial diamonds.
Men have been trying to do that for centuries. Cranks, the lot of them.
My friend is not a crank. He says that it's theoretically possible to make diamonds in the laboratory. All that's lacking is the method. Why should you not discover that method?
Me? Make diamonds? Well, why not? Why not?
It was a fantastic idea, but that was a fantastic era. The next day, Edward Acheson called on Dr. King at his hotel in the Faubourg Saint-Germain.
Well, what can I do for you, Mr. Acheson?
Well, sir, I want some information about diamonds.
Diamonds, eh?
I'm told that you know more about them than most, so... Well, I believe in consulting an expert in all matters of inquiry.
Good for you. That way you'll never get wrong information. Now, guess what did you want to know?
Well, I know the diamond is a crystalline form of carbon, but how is it actually made? In nature, I mean.
Diamonds, my boy, were formed millions, billions of years ago, when the world was a molten mass under the stresses and strains of tremendous heat and pressure.
Heat and pressure, eh? The arc furnace.
Listen. You haven't been bitten by the artificial diamond bug, have you?
Well, there might be something in it. And if there was, I'd be richer than Croesus.
Nothing doing. For a scientist, that's very loose thinking. Let me tell you something, Acheson. Diamonds are precious and have great value simply because they're scarce. And even so, the world's diamond merchants stick together and keep the price up. I know.
But...
Just a minute. Let me finish. Suppose you discover how to make them in the laboratory. What happens? Your process leaks out. Everybody makes them. Then they're not scarce anymore. Down comes the price. And what are you making then? Beads. Strings of beads that people will be able to buy for $1.50.
I never thought of that. Well, there goes a dream. Still, it was nice while it lasted.
But as time went on, Acheson became more and more sure that there was a fortune in artificial diamonds, despite what Dr. King had said. And in the succeeding 10 years, he worked intermittently on the problem. He pinned his faith for the required heat on the arc furnace he understood so well, and whose temperatures were higher than any others found on Earth. But by 1891, he was almost prepared to abandon his quest, when Lady Luck threw a remarkable discovery in his path. He was working in a Monongahela City powerhouse, owned by Edison, and where an arc furnace was installed. On this day, Acheson was using a carbon electrode of powdered coke and experimenting with various clay. Maybe this time, he said to himself, I will make an artificial diamond.
Hello, Edward.
Still looking for your artificial diamonds?
Uh-huh. Not for much longer.
Well, what have you got in the crucible?
An unusual clay from a pottery works just outside town. Corundum, it's called.
Well, look here. When you're through, I want you to read this.
Uh-huh.
It's a report on a new chrome tungsten steel. So hard that it can't be worked. Can't grind it, can't cut it, can't machine it.
Not even with emery?
Emery won't look at it. That's how hard it is.
Hmm, that's rather interesting. Would you move your head a bit? I want to see the clock.
Sure.
35 minutes, that ought to be enough. Well, let's switch off and have a look. Mm-mm. As usual, nothing. Nothing at all.
Uh-huh. And what do you call this?
Where?
Here, stuck to the carbon. Little gray crystals.
Oh, those. Oh, I've had those dozens of times. I don't know what they are, but they're certainly not diamonds.
They look as if they'd be pretty hard. Are they?
I never tested them to see. Just check them out.
Well, let's step over to the window and see how they behave on glass. Now then. Well, I'll be doggone. Why, look at that. These crystals will scratch glass, see?
Say, I wonder if it'll scratch diamond.
We'll soon see. Well, look, take my ring and try. Oh,
you don't mind if I ruin it?
If that crystal scratches my diamond, you'll be able to afford 20 new ones. Try it.
It does. It's as hard as diamond. Say, Mr. Edison, is this what you're looking for grinding and cutting that chrome steel?
Is it? And all this time, you've had it right under your nose, the abrasive that industry has been praying for, and you've been chucking it out. Now you'll have to give it a name. What are you going to call the stuff?
Well, it's probably a compound of corundum and carbon, so, what about, carborundum? Yeah, that's it. Carborundum.
By pure luck, Edward Goodrich Aitchison had discovered the world's finest abrasive, a substance that has never been improved upon. Later, he learned that it was silicon carbide, the second hardest substance known to man, and its discovery opened the way to tremendous advances in metallurgy and industry. For without carborundum, modern industry would be paralyzed. Aitchison founded a great company and became a rich man, and all by accident. He was not looking for an abrasive that day in the powerhouse. He was trying to make diamonds. So that the invention of carborundum was not a matter of intent. It was merely a matter of luck.
The stories of the discovery of the surgical use of radium and of carborundum were dramatized by Lindsay Hardy from Factual Research Material and were directed by Donovan Joyce. The performers included David Lowe, Alfred Bristow, Kevin Brennan, John Bushell, Dinah Shearing, Alan Trevor, Leonard Teal, Reg Collins, and Margaret Christensen. Your narrator was Ward Leopold, who invites you to listen again 1 week from now, same night, time, and station, for a further fascinating half-hour presentation of A Matter of Luck, a Donovan Joyce production.